It's Hometown Alaska. I'm Charles Wolfarth, and today's show is for the gearhead in all of us, and also for the historian in all of us. We're going to be talking about a remarkable project to restore a steam locomotive and a remarkable project to restore a historic passenger airliner, both of which happened here, and both of which are creating historic vehicles that we'll be able to appreciate for a long time. And in the studio today, we have the folks who worked on those projects and can tell us about the history of transportation in Alaska and about the process of restoring a transportation relic such as your old MG in the garage, which is never actually going to get restored, right? So the two guests, Mark Ransom is with the Alaska Aviation Heritage Museum. Mark, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
And Patrick Durand is president of the Locomotive Number 557 Restoration. Thanks for being with us, Patrick.
Thank you for having us here.
And we'd love to hear from you. If you have questions about the locomotive or the aircraft we're going to talk about the Aviation Museum or the Locomotive Restoration, about the history of these objects, or maybe you've got your own stalled restoration project sitting up on blocks in the backyard, and you have some thoughts or questions about how you get that accomplished, or maybe you just want to brag about something you've done. The number for us is 550-8433, 550-8433. Statewide, it's 888-353-5752, and you can reach us on email at hometown@alaskapublic.org. Patrick, tell us about locomotive number 557. This is like a big classic locomotive that looks like it comes out of a storybook.
It came out of Alaska's storybook. 557 was one of 12 locomotives identical that came to Alaska in 1943 and 44, along with the 714th Railway Operating Battalion to help support the railroad during the war effort. And it and one other survive. Of course, almost everybody in Anchorage knows 556 from its prominent position on the park strip.
Mm-hmm. And this is a very similar engine.
This is one of its 2,120 sisters.
Okay.
The largest class of locomotives ever built in this country as far as steam engines go.
Oh, wow.
And they were distributed worldwide. You can find them on every continent except Antarctica and Australia. And
What was this engine? What was this particular engine used for?
It was in general service. It was used initially, for freight, and they commonly used them in passenger service here in Alaska. The Seward run, the turn in and out of Whittier, when they first arrived. And the last operation on this locomotive was in 1959 for the Alaska State Fair Special. And we're looking forward to the time that we can duplicate that trip.
Half a century later. I bet a lot of wear and tear could go on on an engine that's not being used for half a century, huh?
Well, its last use was in the floodwaters at Denana. A steam locomotive can run in about 3 foot of water, so when the Denana and the Tanana flooded, they would take the steam engine there, and they would disconnect from the diesels at the high water mark and tow the train through with the steam engine. Of course, that kind of operation didn't do it any favors maintenance-wise, but that was the last time it was used here in Alaska, and then it was put on the scrap line.
1966. Wow, so much to learn about that. I'm really the questions are multiplying in my head, but I want to introduce our other guest, Mark Ransom, from the Alaska Aviation Heritage Museum. The museum is constantly restoring aircraft.
Constantly.
And you've got even this place, when you go to the museum to visit, you can actually go in and watch restoration taking place, which I think is one of the most interesting parts of the whole museum.
It's actually one of the more popular things that our visitors and guests find when they come there, is talking to the guys that actually do that kind of work.
Uh-huh. Now, tell me about this aircraft, the Pilgrim. That's the right name, right?
The Pilgrim, yes. It was by a company called American. It was made in the Fairchild facilities in the lower 48. It's a 1931. They were all made in 1931. There were only about 26 of them made total. About half of those went to the military. The other half went to American Airways. And that was at a time when they had been enclosing the passengers for a while, but the pilot still sat out like a rodeo rider. And,
oh my gosh!
the Pilgrim is one of the first to actually enclose the pilot. Now he was still separated from the passenger cabin, which turned out to have a plus. He couldn't hear the passengers screaming, but there was another plus. The passengers couldn't hear the pilot screaming. That was at a time when the CAA, the forerunner of the FAA, was starting to flex some muscle. And they said, look, you guys are flying in at night. You're flying in weather. You've got a single pilot. You have single set of controls. We want dual pilot, dual set of controls. And about 18 months after the Pilgrim was introduced, the DC-2 and DC-3 came out, and American went with them. And that freed up all these Pilgrims, which were very sturdy, reliable aircraft, and Alaska was a very natural stage for them to land in. Harold Gillam, a famous bush pilot in Alaska, owned three of them at one time. They were very ubiquitous in the war effort by civilian contractors. This particular airplane, 709 Yankee, has been in Alaska since 1936. It was used and abused by a number of people. Alaska Airlines made use of it for about 18 years. And so it is in the Alaska Airlines, the star colors that we have it in now. And it's one of the first aircraft, for example, to have a lavatory, one of the first to have baggage racks, luggage racks.
Sort of a modern airliner.
Airliner in the sense that we think of it now, yes.
Yeah. So how many passengers would it carry?
It was made for 9. They would do 10 or more. They would take live cattle in it. They would mining equipment, anything they could fit into it.
So kind of somewhat the equivalent of an Otter these days.
It's actually much larger than that. It's the largest single-engine airliner ever made in America.
Really?
Only the AN Anatoly in Soviet Russia is larger as a single-engine airliner that I know of.
Uh-huh. Well, we've already got a caller, so I want to let him go ahead so he doesn't have to wait too long. Keith, what was your question?
My question is, where are you doing the work at, and can I come look at it and even participate maybe?
On the locomotive.
On the locomotive.
All
yes.
Right. Patrick?
We are in the old Kenai Supply Lumber Warehouse in Wasilla. It's a property that belonged to the railroad. They've just repainted it. The easy way to find it is find Burger King and look across the railroad tracks. You'll see our sign on the side of the building. And
okay, I know where that's at.
Okay. We're there Mondays. Wednesdays, Thursdays, and Saturdays with the full crew, and the entire crew is volunteers. So
Monday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday,
and Saturdays.
All right, and they have a website, and that you can find that on alaskapublic.org, and so you can hook up. And
yeah,
and do you just take anybody who walks in the door, or do you just try to make sure they have some?
Well, we do an interview in the process of walking around the facility, It's amazing the range of skills that we have developed there. We have retired pharmacists. Much of the crew are retired folks, but we also capture a lot of the younger people and ladies on Saturday.
Uh-huh.
And there are about 30 people in what we call the 557 Mechanical Department right now, all volunteers. And at any given time, we'll have anywhere from 3 to 8 or 9 working in the facility.
So it sounds like you could get involved if you want to, Keith.
I look forward to it as soon as I can get out there.
All right. Thanks for calling. So
the
Aviation Museum also has a volunteer program. How can people get involved in that?
Basically the same way. Come by and we have an application process. After we frisk them, everything's downhill after that. No, I'm only kidding. It's the same kind of a situation. We have a number of volunteers already. All of our labor is volunteer. Anybody's welcome to come by and check it out and play a part. If you just wanted to see it, just come by and come through the museum. It's part of the admission and tour of the museum.
Yeah, that's the starting point. It's really fun just to watch the work being done and talk to guys who are doing this work and learning how they do it. And if you're super mechanically adept, you can probably, get on as a volunteer. If you're butterfingers, you could do the fundraising, right?
or if your Butterfinger's like me, you can do some of it in the, you know, the parts that don't really matter that much.
They can fix it, right? So I want to know how you get a locomotive that is not operable from place to place. I mean, this is an immensely heavy object.
It is 162,000 pounds.
Wow.
Not quite as awkward as aircraft when it comes to moving them, because they are on wheels and you can roll them, and you want to roll it wherever you can.
Mm-hmm.
Lifting is problematic. We can thank the good folks who have supported us right from the beginning with this project in transportation. And Scott Hicks at Alaska West Express trucked the locomotive from Anchorage to Palmer. It came up on the barge from Seattle. That was all prepaid. The railroad moved it from Moses Lake, where it had been in the museum, to Seattle.
Moses Lake?
Washington.
So it had been
out in the eastern desert in Washington.
Okay.
Yeah. And without those in-kind donations, major money would have been expended to get it here.
I mean, the shipping alone would have put you out of business. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, yeah. It wouldn't be something you'd like to post on the budget.
Right. Right. So, and when you got it, it looked more or less like a locomotive, when you got started on it, you made it look less and less like a locomotive as you went along.
Right now, it looks like a lot of locomotive parts. It's mm-hmm. taken us 2 years to get to this point, and in the process, we've rebuilt a lot of the components of the machine. The drivers have all been machined. That was another expensive transportation, 28,000 pounds going to Chattanooga, Tennessee, to the Tennessee Valley Railroad Museum, where they have equipment to turn 57-inch drivers.
Drivers, what does that mean?
Those are the wheels under the locomotive.
Okay, sure.
All of their bearings and pins had to be reworked.
Wow, that must have cost
back
a fortune.
Well, about $16,000 in machine work.
Yeah.
But that would have been far overshadowed by the transportation cost if mm-hmm. it hadn't been for Lyndon, who always steps into the breach when it comes to moving anything for us.
Custom machine work, I was going to hold off with this question, but I can't help myself, is where do you get the technical specs and plans? I mean, do they still exist, or do you
send? When we started this project, we had one elevation drawing and some sections. And we were told that drawings didn't exist. But in reviewing the shipping documents for those 2,120 locomotives, every one was shipped with a complete set of plans that weighed 62 pounds.
Oh, my gosh.
So they exist somewhere. And our Secretary-Treasurer, Dick Morris, went on the mission. And so far, he's pulled plans from Tasmania and Poland and England and California State Railroad Museum and Allen County Historical Society. They're there. You have to know what to ask for in the let's just call it piles of paper
right.
that have never really been cataloged yet.
Right, because it's not something that people have been using, right?
That's right.
And I know Alaska Railroad files, super historic files, are pretty much not cataloged at all.
The files from those days that related to steam locomotives were lost in a roundhouse fire.
Oh.
And then when the archives kept moving around, any other residuals were gone. So
yeah. We're
really fortunate. There are four of these locomotives in operation or very close to operation in England.
Oh, really?
And so the S-160 is popular because of its wide distribution in all those national railroad systems mm-hmm. around Europe. And Poland was still operating these in 1986.
Wow.
And that's where we get a lot of our technical upgrades.
Durable machines.
Yes.
Yeah.
They were after they were rebuilt.
Right. It's Hometown Alaska. I'm Charles Woolforth, and we're talking about historic transportation relics that are being refurbished. This locomotive from the Alaska Railroad. Patrick Durand is the president of the Locomotive Number 557 Restoration Project, who's just speaking. And Mark Ransom was with the Alaska Aviation Heritage Museum. they're constantly restoring aircraft, and just in the last couple of years, completed restoration of this very historic passenger aircraft, the Pilgrim, which is now on display at the museum.
On display at the museum. Actually, just wrapped up a season of taking people for rides, and we'll be putting it in its winter home for the winter. But, of course, restoration projects continue to go on. We have a P-40 restoration project underway and has been for a few years.
Wow. So same question as I was asking Patrick about plans and specs. I mean, a plane that was manufactured in the 1930s and only a couple of dozen copies, probably no plans available, I would think.
On the Pilgrim, it's a little bit difficult. The warbirds, like the P-40 that we're working on now, those are usually in existence somewhere, and it's a matter of just tracking them down. The Pilgrim is a little bit of a different story. There were only a limited number made in the first place, and because they had such limited service, the records are not as easily tracked. A lot of fabrication just has to be done out of thin air, and of course, people don't do that for free. Even though our labor is volunteer labor, mm-hmm. The things need to be fabricated, parts need to be ordered at times, and none of that is free, of course. So it's just like with the locomotive restoration; it's fundraising is an ongoing process, and all donations are certainly appreciated. Anytime somebody walks in the door and wants to see the museum and plop down a couple of dollars of their hard-earned money, we certainly appreciate it.
Yeah. So in terms of fabricating parts, you're sort of looking at it, figuring out what it's going to do, where it fits, and sort of redesigning it, I guess, and then giving it to machinists to create.
Exactly. Well, in the project we have going on right now with the P-40, that's exactly the challenge that we're facing. Everything from the cockpit back is, for the most part, non-existent. And so our guys are having to take photographs and drawings and just refabricate everything from the cockpit on back on that one. The wings are available, even though they're going to take some major work, but it's the back part of the cockpit that's going to take the most effort.
So the P-40 is a World War II fighter?
It's a World War II fighter. People are familiar with it if they remember the flying tigers with the shark's teeth painted on them. Uh-huh. It's the Warhawk.
Truly the classic World War II aircraft, yeah.
And they were all over in the Aleutian campaign, so, and that's where this one was eventually scavenged from, was out on the chain.
So it's an aircraft that maybe crashed or was shot down?
It was shot down.
Action?
Mm-hmm.
Hmm. So do you have all this, the history of what actually happened in,
yes,
in battle?
Yeah, I don't have it with me today, mm-hmm. but we do have that available. Once the aircraft goes on display, of course, that will all be assembled and put in some kind of a presentation format. The wings are on display now as it sits while we wait to complete the entire restoration. And you can see a number of bullet holes all the way through it.
Wow. So, and the fuselage is in the shop and people are working on it?
The fuselage is in the shop, and that's what's being worked on right now. I've had a very small hand in that myself, helping to put things in places and bolt them down and things like that.
Uh-huh. Interesting. Wow. And I would think that you would really, if a plane isn't put together right, it's not going to fly, or might fly for a little while, which is even worse. So obviously we need to talk about how a steam locomotive isn't done right, it'll explode. So we're going to talk a little bit about how you certify that you're doing this work correctly and the challenges behind that. But I want to give folks the number if they have questions about these projects or about anything about it, restoring historical vehicles and the history of Alaska. You can reach us at 550-8433. That's 550-8433. Statewide, the number is 888-353-5752, and you can reach us via email at hometown@alaskapublic.org. And my guests are Patrick Durand with the Locomotive 557 Restoration and Mark Ransom of the Alaska Aviation Heritage Museum. Mark, there's obviously a very rigorous FAA process to certify an airplane. How does the work you're doing fit in with that? I mean, how does that work, especially when you're taking up paying passengers?
Well, there's the FAA is rather strict in how they lay the kinds of work that you can do and the kind that needs to be signed off once it's done. Mm-hmm. And as we go through that process, the parts that need to be signed off are signed off before we go on to something else. So it's an effort by effort signing off, moving on process that goes on throughout the entire project.
I see. Does that cost the museum more to have those inspectors there, or is that?
Well, it's possible at times. I'm speaking outside of my area of expertise here, but we do have volunteers on staff that can certify on behalf of the FAA
that
know whether something is being done the right way or not.
Mm-hmm. Does it the fact that the plane is? I mean, I think people think about going up in a very old airplane that must be very dangerous because they think that planes wear out the way cars do. But in fact, a plane. At least a plane that doesn't go to high altitude will last virtually forever, right? I mean, as long as it's restored.
Yes. The biggest stresses on an aircraft are going to be the weather and violent weather and stresses on metal and wood and so forth. Mm-hmm. But generally speaking, if an aircraft is going through the maintenance procedures it should be going through and the inspections it should be going through, it'll last for decades. Even in a harsh environment like Alaska, we have aircraft DC-2s, DC-3s that are flying cargo every day that were made in the early 1930s.
Yeah, isn't that amazing? It's cool that we can make stuff, or at least we used to know how to make stuff that would really last. So, Patrick, in terms of the locomotive, if you're going to build up high-pressure steam in this thing, it's got to be certified that it's not going to explode.
That's correct.
All right.
And our version of the FAA is the Federal Railway Administration, the FRA. They have extensive regulations, and we also have to comply with the American Association of Railroads. Standards. In fact, next week we'll have our first inspection by the motive power inspector for the Region 8 office of the FRA out of Vancouver, Washington. He'll be here, and his single objective in this visit is to verify that all of the tubes have been removed from the boiler. Every 15 years or 1,472 days of operation, the FRA requires a major inspection of the boiler. Ultrasound measurements of the structural steel in the boiler. Tubes have to be removed and examined, and in most cases, new tubes replaced. So those two numbers, 15 years... You've got to watch your calendar, and then there are actually daily, weekly, monthly reports that have to be filed on the locomotive's condition, whether it's in operation or not. So you don't go through all this effort without establishing a reporting process that meets all those regulatory requirements.
So where do the inspectors come from for a machine that hasn't? It really been in use in the United States in, like, probably, you know, generations. Where's that expertise?
They have the written regulations, and then they rely upon professional engineers. Our professional engineer on this project is Robert Franson. He's with Steam Services of America. He's been here three times so far to advise us on the boiler. He showed us how to do all of the ultrasound measurements, where they needed to be, the frequency of them. There are over 3,000 measurements taken of the thickness of the steel on the boiler itself. And in the process of doing that, we found some suspect material in the firebox. Hmm. And we ended up removing the entire firebox, and the net result of that was about a $300,000 expense that we hadn't anticipated initially.
Wow.
Where Mark and his crew are working with relatively lightweight stuff, the five sheets in the firebox probably come in close to 8,000 pounds.
Wow.
And yes.
That's a lot of steel.
Yeah. And there are only 1,042 little holes in those pieces that have to match the 1,042 little holes in the outer shell. And each one of those gets plugged with what's called a stay bolt. And stay bolts in this machine will cost us between $110 and $240 a piece, depending on where they go in the process.
Wow.
And that, all of that engineering, there's a factor of four in the safety design of a steam locomotive boiler. And that's what the PE is going to put his stamp on the boiler when it's done.
Professional engineer.
Mm-hmm. Certifying that. And
he's using a manual that has been passed down from our grandfathers.
The FRA, the federal government, really wasn't involved in locomotive boilers for many years until the major railroads stopped using them, and then they became tourist attractions.
I got you.
Then it became necessary for them to step in, because before that, these were the working machines, the money makers for the railroads, and right. They made darn sure that they weren't going to have a problem. Mm-hmm. So the customary maintenance features and processes that were established by the major railroads are the core of the FRA regulations.
Interesting.
In fact.
So we've got a caller. Jennifer is on the line. You have a question?
Yes, I did. It was actually, you were talking about the other steam, the sister steam locomotive, O556. And I was just curious if anybody knows why it is, or your guest knows, or maybe other listeners know why it is that it has been shut off from the public. I know it went through an asbestos abatement type of process for a couple of years, but when all was said and done, it's now been kind of blocked off. And I would imagine that maybe some of the volunteers that you have out there doing the current restoration kind of fell in love with the romance of the old steam engines by being able to climb around on relics like old 556 and reading the storybooks that are out there for kids. And
I know I did when I was a kid because I climbed all over it when I was little. You're talking about the one down on the park strip at East Street and 9th. Patrick, do you know the story?
Well, basically it's a risk management function. And you'll have to talk to the Parks and Recreation people about the process that they went through to establish that. It's really a monument at this point. It's not what is a politically correct play implement. And that was the decision that they came to, is that it was not a play toy.
In the sense that Engine 1 at the depot is kind of in that status, right?
Is in that status, and mm-hmm. it's up on a pedestal, and there is
most
risk.
Most parents
to
wouldn't
it.
Let their kid go up there because it's high, but we always played on the engine down on the park strip, and times have changed, I guess. You know, yep. People are more risk averse, and they're more likely to sue and all that. So it's sad, I think. But we don't have anybody here from the Muni, so we can't get a total answer on that. If somebody wants to call from the municipality and give us a straight scoop on that, we'd sure. Totally put them on
well,
the air.
I appreciate you fielding the question, and it's sad, and I'll plead my case in other places, but thanks so much. This is I worked as a tour guide on the railroad once upon a time, and it was an awesome experience and a great way to see our state. So I'm glad to know this kind of work is happening, so thanks a lot.
Great, thanks. And I think Jim has a question on the same topic. Jim?
Yes, I used to take my son down there and play on that engine there in Park Strip in 1969-70. Time period, and I went back in the early 80s and to revisit it, and I noticed this white powder all over the place. So I contacted the municipality of Anchorage and told them they need to maybe check that engine for asbestos, and sure enough, it was a problem.
Mm.
So how do you deal with asbestos now when you do restoration or any other hazardous materials? Because what we deal with now is a lot different than what they used to deal with when they manufactured these things.
Did you find asbestos when you opened up this engine?
557 had the insulation of the day, which was asbestos. And one of our major in-kind contributors, Central Environmental Services, came to our aid. They enclosed the entire end of the building. They had five people there for a week and hauled off 8 cubic yards of asbestos and gave us a clean bill of health.
Was this and this was another in-kind contribution?
This was a $46,500 in-kind contribution.
Wow. I want to talk about the money involved in this when we come back from the break, but first I want to ask Mark Ransom from the Aviation Heritage Museum, do you have issues with hazardous materials when you're working with historic planes?
Not so much. They didn't use a lot of insulation in older airplanes, but there
they
are.
They didn't use chewing gum and baling wire, right?
Yes. Well, nowadays, what we're looking for is reliability. So the modifications that we might make now have more to do with making sure that something is more reliable than it might have been at that time. But I'm sure there are hazardous materials that come into play from time to time. It's one of those areas I'm not familiar with.
All right. Well, we're talking about refurbishing a locomotive, refurbishing airplanes. We have a guest who is working on this, rebuilding the steam locomotive, which is once again going to pull passengers on the Alaska Railroad. A guest from the Alaska Aviation Heritage Museum. We'll be talking to them more after the break. And your questions. I'll give out those phone numbers and email address when we come back from this short break. And Hometown Alaska continues.
You're listening to Hometown Alaska from Alaska Public Media. The program repeats tonight at 9 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage and will not be taking phone calls. You can find Hometown Alaska on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
It's Hometown Alaska. I'm Charles Wolforth, and we're talking today about restoring Alaska's transportation history. There's a big project going on to restore a working steam locomotive, and Patrick Durand is with me. He's the president of the Locomotive 557 Restoration Project, and Mark Ransom is with me from the Alaska Aviation Heritage Museum. I hope all of our listeners have been to the museum. It is really a fun and exciting place to go, and there's constantly aircraft being restored there. And not long ago, they finished restoring a remarkable passenger aircraft in the 1930s. So that's our topic today, and we welcome your calls and your questions via email. The phone number here is 550-8433, 550-8433. Are you restoring something? Any questions about the history of these important transportation objects that come from our past? Statewide, the number is 888-353-5752, or you can email us at hometown@alaskapublic.org. So, Mark Ransom, it seems to me that the aviation is really the heart of the history of Alaska. I mean, there's a sign I saw on one tour, and I've been through the museum many times, but my favorite is this sign that says, walk a week or ride an hour, basically, as an advertisement. Do I have it right?
That was an advertisement, yes.
Yeah, an advertisement for flying, because we basically went from dog sled to airplanes. We skipped railroad going anywhere but one line, and we skipped roads.
Mm-hmm.
And so the history you're teaching people about is really the essential history of our state.
It is, in a big way, because even today the roads are very limited. So you've got air transportation as the only way to get to most places in the state. The road system does not cover most places in the state, and it was a rough and tumble time because there were no runways, there was no infrastructure. We had to use balloon tires because the early pilots were landing on tree stumps. They were landing on gravel bars. We had to have early pilots that got very good at such things as taking off in one set of conditions, landing in another set of conditions, and then returning back to the original set of conditions again. And there were not amphibious floats, and there were not wheel skis. So they got good at landing on ice with floats or landing on mudflats with skis, and so they could go do those things that required some versatility. And so it's a totally different kind of flying than was ever done in the lower 48. I'm going to put in one plug here that the things that you see at the Alaska Aviation Museum are the things you will not see anywhere in any other aviation or aerospace museum and vice versa, because our charter is very narrow. Everything that's in the museum has to be Alaska-specific, number one, and it has to be meaningful to Alaskan aviation history. So you're not going to see NASA things there. Mm-hmm. You're not going to see those kinds of things. You're going to see things that only relate to Alaska and Alaskan aviation history. So be that as it may, it still takes the average person over 2 hours. If you don't watch any of the seven movies in the museum, mm-hmm. Through the tour, it still takes the average person 2 hours to see what we do have. It's quite substantial.
Plus whatever time you want to spend in the shop watching the restoration taking place, or maybe you take a flight from, you know, from the lake there.
Yeah. And to put in a plug, just the day before yesterday, Monday night, we opened up the old Merrifield control tower cab, which we have restored and put on the property there on a one-story base. It's got a commanding view of the lake and the channel, and we have the radio traffic from Lake Hood Tower coming into it, so you can listen to the radio traffic and watch the operations at the same time. So
one of the things that's always blown my mind about those early aviators who opened up Alaska is that they had, how the heck did they figure out where they were, right? I mean, there were no landmarks, and the maps were extremely primitive, and they had no weather forecast. So it was really like setting out into the complete unknown.
It was, and some of the early pilots were not particularly good navigators. Ben Ileson got lost every time he took off. It's a kind of a featureless place in some areas, especially when you get into the interior and you go from one drainage to another drainage, and everything kind of looks alike. And yeah, they did have to kind of feel their way through. Once they got familiar with a particular area, though, most of them got pretty good. But it took a while, and a few of them had to do what pilots like to call it, the infamous off-airport landing occasionally, and walk out in order to get that experience.
So the aircraft that they were flying back in those early days, and you've just restored this 1930s aircraft, I'm assuming they did not have the power or the capabilities of the planes that we fly today.
Surprisingly, they were starting to get to that point.
Really?
The Pilgrim, for example, is a very powerful aircraft. It's a very large aircraft. It's the first thing that strikes you when you come up to it is the size of it. It's the largest single-engine airliner made in America, and it's just huge. But it could get in and out of places and had a lot of power to it. Hmm. So at the time of the early 30s, they were starting to get in some pretty powerful machines.
So in some ways, the technology is maybe for the general aviation hasn't changed that much in quite a while.
Hasn't changed a lot.
Cockpit technology has, but the actual plane hasn't changed that much.
That's correct.
Yeah. So in terms of the Alaska Railroad, obviously it was completed in 1923, and I've just done a lot of work on that because I've written a history of Anchorage for the Centennial, which is going to be coming out, I guess, later this year. And learned that the railroad was really struggled along in its first couple of decades, lost a lot of money, had, you know, the track hadn't been built to high standards, the old worn-out rolling stock that was from Panama, from the Panama Canal. And then when the World War II came around, they got a big infusion of new equipment and new money, and that's where this locomotive came from. It's when World War II got started.
That's correct. Colonel Olson was the president of the railroad at that time, and the surge of material coming into the territory during the war, specifically into Seward, they foresaw that they would not be able to handle that amount of traffic over the two divides coming out of Seward. And that was the impetus for building Whittier. And that eliminated two mountain passes.
And digging that two-mile-long tunnel.
And digging that two-mile-long tunnel was the challenge.
Yeah.
Steam locomotives in this class joined an extensive fleet of equipment that had been here since the Panama Canal days.
Mm-hmm.
You know, 1914-15, when they first started bringing that equipment up from the Panama, it was converted in Panama City to standard gauge and then shipped up here on all kinds of makeshift facilities. Some of the ships were actually Great Lakes ore carriers that they put deck loads on, and they looked like submarines coming up the Pacific.
Just hope you don't have a storm, I guess, right?
Yeah. And so that was supplemented by some larger new equipment that they got in the 40s. And then in 1948, they started getting diesel locomotives. They got two specifically under special compensation with the Federal Wartime Administration. Number 1000 and 1001 were Alco RS-1s. So they could make it through the tunnel into Whittier without producing a lot of smoke.
Hmm.
That was the first requirement for diesel locomotives.
But they were still adding steam locomotives to the line, which seems like it would have been old technology by then.
Well, it was what was available in a hand-me-down situation.
I got you.
And being a federal agency, the Alaska Railroad got special I'm trying to think of the right word here.
Dispensation.
Dispensation is the correct word from Congress in 1948 to pick up federal surplus for nothing.
Oh, wow.
So if it had been used in a war effort or if it was sitting on some land reclamation site and the railroad could use it, all they had to do is make the request.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how the railroad was supplied for quite a while.
So this engine that you're restoring, its life didn't begin with the Alaska Railroad. Where was it operating before that?
Well, actually, this particular one was new. The 12 that came here were new for the war effort. And when they arrived, they were put into immediate service.
Uh-huh. And then it functioned, you said, until 1966. And then what happened to it?
Well, a fella in Moses Lake, Washington, Monty Holm, who was an old hobo and a junk dealer, bought it for scrap for $1,275.
That's a lot of metal to buy for that amount of money.
And he had the foresight to take it to his museum called the House of Poverty, right on the main drag going through Moses Lake. And he would occasionally operate it for the community. And when Monty finally passed away, his two of his best friends, Jim and Vic Jansen, bought the locomotive from his estate and then turned around and donated it to the Alaska Railroad on provision that they make it operational within 8 years.
Hmm.
And they have been the spark plugs behind it. So we owe the existence of the machine to those people with the foresight. And on this end of the operation, at that point in time, Chris Odneson was the president and CEO of the Alaska Railroad, and he saw this as an opportunity to bring some of our history back and put a shot in the arm for the morale of the railroad, and mm-hmm. thought this was an excellent way to do it. And I
had the railroad CEO on the show not long ago, and I know they've been going through some pretty major challenges. Are that they're not paying for this project?
No, they're not paying for this project. When this was originally proposed, the Rasmussen Foundation stepped forward to kick the project off with a very generous grant of $350,000 as a matching grant.
Mm-hmm.
And we're very close to maxing that out. And
so you've raised another $350,000, so you're up to close to $700,000.
Right.
Wow.
Of course, in the process, when you have surprises like the firebox, the budget grows and the need mm-hmm. for funding grows. Actually, the cash requirement is equaled by the in-kind donations that we've received on an almost a dollar-for-dollar basis. The business support in Alaska has been phenomenal.
Everybody loves a train.
Everybody loves a train. And they see a successful project underway, and they want to be part of it. They want to be on board.
So you're pushing towards $1.5 million on this thing?
By the time it's done, the combination of in-kind and cash is going to be closer to $2 million.
Not counting your volunteer hours.
Not counting a single volunteer hour.
Which are infinite, it sounds
Which are infinite.
Yeah.
There's over 10,000 man hours into it over the last two years.
So what's the timeline? How long have you been at it, and how long do you think it'll take before the engine is actually running?
In August, we celebrated our second year in the engine house. And we expect for it to be operational in June of 2016. And if you don't set a goal, you can't make it.
All right.
And that's what we're working toward at this point.
It's Hometown Alaska. I'm Charles Wolfworth, and we're talking about restoring Alaska's transportation history. That was Patrick Durand as president of the Locomotive 557 Restoration Project. They're rebuilding a steam locomotive that will run again on the Alaska Railroad tracks 50 years after its last run in 1966. And also with me is Mark Ransom from the Alaska Aviation Heritage Museum, who they also restore aircraft, and you can go out and see them doing it at the museum there near the airport. Well worth doing. I don't think there's anybody who wouldn't find something fascinating in that museum. And if you have questions or comments, we have about 15 minutes left. The number here is 550 855-850-8433. That's 550-8433. Statewide, it's 888-353-5752. Email is at hometown@alaskapublic.org. Mark, the Aviation Museum is kind of a center for aviation buffs in Anchorage. And we had an email here talking about how it's a common place for wakes and funerals for pilots to be held. And is that true? I mean, is there sort of a community of folks out there?
Well, one of the things that we do to raise money mm-hmm. is, of course, our facilities are always available for rent, and there's a number of functions that would take place out there at any given time. And you bring up something that is kind of interesting. If people, the best way at an individual, I mean, obviously, by the time we get done with a Pilgrim project like that, we're looking at $1 to $2 million to complete something like that.
Right. So similar to the locomotive.
Very similar to the locomotive. And I want to echo Pat, too, that, you know, businesses are great in supporting what we do. Foundations are great in supporting what we do. If you're an individual who would like to support what we do, you can become a member of the museum. And what mm-hmm. that allows you to do is for $75, your entire family can just come and go without having to pay admission and see what goes on there. You get discounts in the gift store. But if you wanted to rent one of our facilities, our main hangar, or you could rent our 737 for a birthday party
oh, really?
Or a wedding or a meeting. We've done that before.
Oh,
our
fine.
New tower cab you could rent. If you wanted to do that, it's a substantial discount to members, and of uh-huh. course, it all helps the museum be able to do this, keep the doors open, and restore aircraft, and keep the education flowing. It's a proven fact that any time spent in or around airplanes or trains is not subtracted from your lifespan.
Right. Well, at least you gotta enjoy life. And so, tell me about this particular plane, where it came from, the Pilgrim. I mean, how did you get it, and how did you sort of get this project started?
The Pilgrim was the fifth Model A Pilgrim that was made. It was made specifically for American Airways, and it served with them for a year or two, a couple of years actually, and then it underwent an overhaul, got a little bit better engine on it. It was modified to what they called the B model in 1934, and then in 1936 it was acquired by an outfit called Alaska Air Express, and it was brought to Alaska. We have video on display in the museum of this airplane, the exact same airplane being used all over the bush, doing different kinds of cargo jobs. So it's really an Alaska treasure. I don't know if some people know or not, but we had a predecessor aviation museum here in Anchorage that I used uh-huh. to go to when I was a kid.
I remember it, yeah.
And it burned down in 1973, mm-hmm. and we lost a lot of really old aircraft and things that could go in a museum.
Yeah.
This museum started in 1988, and it started with a fellow named Ted Spencer. He mm-hmm. was a driving force behind it, and he got wind of this particular airplane becoming available. Its last paying job was hauling fish for Ball Brothers, and lost its airworthiness in the 1980s. So when that happened, we had the opportunity to buy it, but of course that required money. And so the fundraising effort really began. We got a couple of state grants and things like that.
The museum really struggled along in its early years.
It did. And, well, it struggles along day to day now.
All right. There you go.
Yeah. We're still trying to keep the doors open and keep aircraft restored. But it was quite an effort. And it didn't stop once we acquired the aircraft in 2002. The fundraising effort keeps going because we have to, you know, we had to ultimately come up with about $1 to $2 million to get the thing completed. So those things are just ongoing, and mm-hmm. We do have a lot of great support from the business community. Individuals, like I say, can be members and support it that way as well. Mm-hmm. And there are a lot of other benefits that go with the membership. Just a matter of going online and checking that out, and we send a lot of things out on email that our members get advantage of. But it helps the museum, and it helps us to do what we do.
So do you get actual, like, professional airplane mechanics who come and volunteer? Like, I mean, I think they get enough of that kind of work during the week.
Well, a lot of them are retired.
Okay.
And, you know, it's one of those things where my dad, for example, after he retired, he says, I don't know when I found time to work before I retired. So, you know, these guys now have the time to go do the things that they wanted to do. Many of them are still working, but they come out because it's really a labor of love. It's a cause that is really close to their heart, and they mm-hmm. they want to see these kinds of aircraft preserved and the education continue.
Well, you know, the museum is truly a mission-driven entity in that you're constantly, like, trying to keep the doors open, yet you're also constantly buying and restoring these million-dollar airplanes, right?
You know, yes, it's like, and we restore them to flying condition. We don't restore them to static display. Now, we do have a few exceptions to that, but by and large, we try to get our aircraft into a flying condition.
And you were saying you were giving rides on the Pilgrim. Do you have other aircraft that you actually use and take people out on?
We have some that could, but it's all a matter of being insured. It's a matter of having a current or airworthiness certification. So it's right now the Pilgrim was the only one this summer we were giving rides with.
It seems like the museum's a huge part of Anchorage. People in Alaska love aviation. People know about it, but it's kind of hidden out there. I mean, it's not like the first place you would stumble upon. There's a little tiny sign, you know, as you're going out to the airport, Air Museum, but otherwise you kind of have to go looking for it. And I wonder if that affects the number of
people. I'm sure it does. And of course, if anybody out there, you know, has a $2 million sign they would like to donate, we would be more than willing to accept it. But believe it or not, the people who come out, when we find out how they found out about us, the sign is the number one reason, the number one thing that brings them in. If we had a much better sign, we'd probably have much better attendance as far as our admissions are concerned.
Yeah.
It's a little hard. We're the largest real estate on the lake, Lake Hood, but we're the size of a postage stamp when it comes to being able to store and display aircraft. So,
right. Are you out of space there?
We've been out of space there since we got there.
Mm-hmm. So where do you keep the other airplanes then?
We have other places that they are right now. We've got a DC-3 that we don't have room to display right now. We've got a DC-6 that will be on display. There's a parking garage going up at International Airport and Jewel Lake Road there where the old armory used to be. And our DC-6 will be on display there.
Oh, how nice.
We have aircraft on display in the Anchorage International Airport. So we find places.
But there's no plans to move. We've got a lot invested there, I guess.
Oh, yeah. Well, there's always talk of the possibility of moving to another space or a larger space. Mm-hmm. But at this point, we don't have any plans to be moving.
So, Patrick, tell me about the plans for the locomotive when it's done.
When it's steaming and we have a crew trained. The business plan forwarded by the railroad was to leave Anchorage at 11 in the morning, go to Portage, turn around on the Y, come back to Girdwood, top off the water tank, and be back in Anchorage by 4:30 in the afternoon. And the consist would be the four oldest dome cars that are still in service on the Alaska Railroad. And they're from the same vintage. They were built in 1948. And I have people asking every day, how can I get on the first trip? And I said, well, make a donation here, and on your check, reference, you want to be notified.
A large check, right?
The larger the better. We'll keep moving them to the top. And the, you know, the impetus for this is a love of the history and machinery. We don't have memberships, but we can infect you if you come out to the engine house. You're very likely to come down with a terminal case of Ferra equinosis.
What's that mean?
Ferra, iron, equine, horse.
Oh, there you go.
Osis is a disease.
I got you.
So we all have Ferra equinosis, the people that are working on it, and we enjoy the comradeship. I'm sure Mark can attest to that. In those working environments where people are focused on a single goal, that it's really a rewarding experience.
It is a brotherhood.
Yeah. And putting in a lot of hours in many diverse ways. I was noticing on your website about, we found us an old welder, you know, and we went out, somebody checked it out, we bought it, now we're restoring the welder so that we can start welding the engine. Multi-step process here.
We put about 10 man hours into that welder, but we paid $800 for a 450-amp welder, and now, you know, if I had to go buy that, it'd be a $6,000 used machine. And so we're pretty proud of our scrounging capabilities. I mean, sandblast equipment, everything on the floor. When we moved in there, it was an empty building. And
you have a nonprofit corporation, I assume, that's doing
all this? The Engine 557 Restoration Company is an Alaska nonprofit. We have applied for our 501c3 status. In the interim, we deal with the Alaska Community Foundation in the administration of the Rasmussen Grant. And we've been very successful. We have a grant writing team who has been successful on 4 out of the 6 applications made. The National Railway Historical Society, who we consider the good housekeeping seal of approval, provided us a $5,000 competitive grant. The Kenai Mountains Turning Arm Heritage Area has provided us with 2 $10,000 grants.
Wow.
And I have informal word that the Atwood Foundation has just approved our request for a $50,000 grant, with $25,000 coming next month and another $25,000 right after the first of the year.
So you've got the money you need at the moment anyway.
At the moment.
What happens, when you're done, you're going to have this amazing shop. Are you going to take on another project?
I hope not.
Somebody else will, huh?
Actually, my goal is to live long enough to see this machine steam. I'm as old as it is.
Uh-huh.
And there's been no talk of another project. Of course, there's an endless number of them out there. But this
you will
one...
be able to, I mean, the traveling public will be able to walk into the Alaska Railroad, plunk down their money, and buy a ticket on a steam train.
Exactly right.
And that's something...
In season...
And that's something that is expected to be a moneymaker, a break-even for them, even with all the maintenance and everything else.
Yeah. Well, the maintenance will probably continue to be provided by this group.
I see.
And
so you're in,
because
it, you really are in for this for a lifetime.
Yeah, it's a unique group of people. And I can't say enough about our chief mechanical officer, mm-hmm. Jeff DeBrock.
Mm-hmm.
He works in the heavy equipment shop with the Alaska Railroad now, but we see him 2 days a week after mm-hmm. hours as our chief mechanical officer. Mm-hmm. And Jeff spent 15 years with the Mount Rainier Scenic Railroad working on their 5 steam locomotives.
So in just a minute we have left, either or both of you gentlemen, what advice do you give to somebody who wants to restore whatever, a car or whatever they're restoring? What sort of any tips?
Seek help immediately.
Find a different hobby.
If your wife says you need to be committed, you have to tell her you are.
Yeah. Okay. But I mean, it's the time, the space, the money. Be committed. I mean, that's really the thing.
Yeah.
You can't take a project on like this without a huge amount of effort.
You have to plan to do something every day.
Mm-hmm.
And I would invite anybody interested in the history of this project or Alaska Railroad mm-hmm. information to go to alaskarails.org.
Mm-hmm.
And at the top of the menu, you'll find 557 and more photographs than you care to view and lot more than you need to know.
If you want to do a restoration project, join with the locomotive guys, join with the Aviation Heritage Museum. It stays there. It won't fill up your garage. You can get your experience and do it that way, right? Great. Well, this has been really fun. I really appreciate both of you guys being here. Patrick Durand is a president of the Locomotive 557 Restoration Project. Mark Ransom is with the Alaska Aviation Heritage Museum. Thanks for being with us, both of you.
Thank you.
Next week on Hometown Alaska, join host Kathleen McCoy to talk about technology in the K-12 curriculum. Same time, same place. Tune in. Pat Yak is the chief content officer for Alaska Public Media. Monica Goki is our web editor and audio engineer. Thanks for joining us today on Hometown Alaska. I'm Charles Wolforth.
Hometown Alaska is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Hometown Alaska's theme song, Lead Dog, is by Kevin Barnett from Eagle River. Learn more about Hometown Alaska and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.